The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the May 12th, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week is a war scene. In the background, it's smoky. There are barren trees. Looks like a small building is on fire. In the very foreground is Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. He's got a stern look on his face. He's in battle gear with his arms crossed. Behind him are two soldiers on foot, and then there's a army tank. Looks like the driver is up out of the cockpit and he's got a thumbs up signal. The headline is "Going on Offense. Can Zelensky and Ukraine drive the Russians out?" And that is our first main story. Ukraine preparing to launch counter-offensive. What happened? Russia accused Ukraine of staging a drone strike on the Kremlin this week as both countries stepped up aerial attacks in advance of an expected Ukrainian spring counteroffensive. Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov said Ukraine is reaching the finish line in preparations for a broad attack on hardened Russian lines, which Ukrainian officials hope will shift the war's momentum after months of bloody stalemate. U.S. officials estimated this week that Russia has sustained 100,000 casualties since December, including 20,000 deaths, many in the ongoing battle over the eastern city of Bakhmut. NATO's Secretary General Jean Stoltenberg said Ukraine is in a strong position to retake occupied territory after NATO members delivered 1,500 armored vehicles, 230 tanks, and vast amounts of ammunition. Reznikov suggested the offensive was close at hand. As soon as there is God's will, the weather, and a decision by the commanders, we will do it, he said. Nobody was injured in the Kremlin drone attack, for which Ukraine denied responsibility. Video showed a drone exploding over the building and its dome on fire. The Kremlin called it an attempt on the president and warned Russia reserves the right to respond. U.S. officials said that the drone strike could be a false flag operation, with one former Pentagon official suggesting it could be a pretext to target Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev said the attack left Russia no choice but to physically liquidate Zelensky. What the columnists said. The stakes for the coming counteroffensive are immense, said Julian E. Barnes in the New York Times. Without a decisive victory, Western support for Ukraine could weaken, and pressure could mount on Kyiv to accept a major loss of territory in negotiations to end the war. Ukraine is freshly armed with extensive artillery and ammunition, and new combat units trained by U.S. and NATO forces. But in the south, where the counteroffensive is expected to unfold, Russia has spent months digging in with elaborate defenses, including minefields, anti-tank ditches, concrete dragon's teeth, and troop-filled trenches. The first 24 hours will likely be decisive, said Franz Stefan Gatti in Foreign Policy. To turn the tide in a war that's become a crucible of attrition, Ukraine's best hope is a focused assault that punches through the Russian lines in both the south and east and sets off paralysis in the Russian military leadership and panic across the Russian rank and file, triggering a chaotic retreat. Getting Russia's tens of thousands of soldiers to abandon their defensive positions without much of a fight is probably the only realistic option for Ukrainians to achieve a quick and deep strategic breakthrough. Ukraine's offensive will have several key objectives, said retired General Mark T. Kimmett in the Wall Street Journal. The Ukrainians need to retake territory critical to the Russians and deliver a defeat decisive enough to strengthen growing doubts about the war in Russia. At the same time, that victory would show a dubious West this is a winnable war and thus reinvigorate Allied support. Thanks to classified documents allegedly leaked by former U.S. Airman Jack Teixeira, the world now knows the Pentagon isn't optimistic, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. Defense analysts judged in February that Ukraine would probably achieve only modest territorial gains in the counteroffensive and that a grinding campaign of attrition would likely continue for a year or more. Still, defense officials note that the Ukrainians have accomplished combat miracles before, and they point to an X factor that could prove decisive: Ukraine's will to win against savage invaders at whatever cost. The future of the democratic world is on the line, said Ann Applebaum and Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic. Putin still believes a long, drawn-out war of attrition will eventually bring him back his empire. If he succeeds, the world becomes a darker, more dangerous place. But Putin's defeat, Zelensky recently told us, would tell the world that sovereignty, human rights, territorial integrity must be respected. In the coming months, Ukraine will have a chance to alter geopolitics for a generation. By providing critical support to our valiant allies in Kyiv, so does the United States. Controversy of the week. Supreme Court. Is it time for a real ethics code? Sorry, John Roberts, but trust me won't work anymore, said James D. Zirin in The Hill. The Senate Judiciary Committee this week held a hearing on the need for an enforceable code of ethics at the Supreme Court, a problem crystallized by the revelation that billionaire conservative donor and activist Harlan Crow had showered millions in lavish vacation trips, gifts, and land purchases on Justice Clarence Thomas, which Thomas chose not to report. Yet Chief Justice Roberts grandly declined to appear before the Senate, citing separation of powers concerns. Roberts reminded Congress in a letter that due to the unique institutional setting of the court, the justice's compliance with ethics rules binding other federal judges is purely voluntary. That won't do, given this court's flagrant conflicts of interest, said Dahlia Lithwick and Mark Joseph Stern in Slate. This week, the New York Times reported that the conservative Antonin Scalia Law School showers lucrative teaching jobs and foreign travel on the conservative justices. Robert's own wife, meanwhile, reportedly earned $10.3 million recruiting lawyers to top firms that sometimes represent litigants at the court. The justices not only enjoy the absolute, unreviewable power of monarchs, evidently they feel entitled to live like kings as well. This isn't about ethics, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Aided by their media researchers, Democrats are using hyped accusations to delegitimize the conservative court, with a goal of tarnishing its ruling and subjecting it to more political control. A binding ethics code for the Supreme Court is a terrible idea, said Jason Willick in the Washington Post. Under the Constitution, the Supreme Court is a co-equal branch of the government that does not answer to Congress or the executive branch. A bipartisan reform proposal now before the Senate calls for the creation of an ombudsman to oversee ethics complaints against the court and recommend responses. But who appoints that overseer and keeps politics out of the oversight? In these polarized times, an ethics body that could go after individual justices would quickly degenerate into a partisan circus. What choice had the justices left us? Asked Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. As retired conservative judge Michael Luttig reminded the Judiciary Committee this week, The court's authority flows entirely from its reputation for impartiality. That means the justice's behavior must be, in Luttig's words, beyond reproach at all times and places, in both public and in private. The jaw-dropping lapses by Justice Thomas have a lot to do with why the court's approval rating is a dismal 40% and falling. If Roberts won't even acknowledge, there's a problem, said Kimberly Atkins Storr in the Boston Globe. Then it's up to the American people, working through our elected representatives, to save the Supreme Court from its justices. The court's legitimacy crisis is compounded by its lawless ruling, said Michael Tomasky in the New Republic. The same reactionary bloc stuffing its pockets with goodies has, not surprisingly, issued a series of extremist rulings on abortion, guns, the environment, and business regulation that delight its various right-wing chums and benefactors. The Supreme Court's conservative majority is firmly committed to one principle, said John Marshall in Talking Points memo. Whether it's vacationing on a billionaire's yacht or reinterpreting the Constitution to suit their personal biases and religious beliefs, the justices have got the power and they're going to use it. If you don't like it, too bad. Our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for populism, with a pledge from Thailand's right-of-center Democratic Party, which is trailing badly in polls, to legalize sex toys if they win. Democrat Ratchada Thanadirik said legalization could lead to a decrease in prostitution as well as divorce due to a mismatch of sexual libido. It was a good week for getting flood insurance after forecasters predicted the 2023 hurricane season will be very active, with five major hurricanes hitting coastal areas in the southeast and Gulf Coast. It was a good week for crescendos after a female concert goer had what was described as a loud, full-body orgasm during the Los Angeles Philharmonic's performance of Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. Ear witness Lucas Burton described the woman's moaning as an expression of pure physical joy. But it was a bad week for Tucker Carlson after a newly revealed text message from the Dominion lawsuit revealed what he thought when he saw a video of three Trump supporters ganging up on an opponent on January 6. "It's not how white men fight," Carlson texted. It was a bad week for snowflakes after Digit, a warehouse robot on display at a trade show in Chicago, collapsed after a mere 20 hours of nonstop shelf stacking. "It's a normal part of any new technology," insisted Liz Klinkenbeard of Agility Robotics. Finally, it's a bad week for whoever they is. After former President Donald Trump told Fox News that while other presidents, including the assassinated Abraham Lincoln, were treated unfairly during their presidencies, they say that Trump was treated worst of all. This week's briefing, the abortion pill. Mifepristone is now at the center of the fight over abortion. Why was it created and approved? What's the pill's origin? In 1970, French endocrinologist and biochemist Étienne-Émile Baillieu had an idea for an unpregnancy pill that could induce abortions. Such a pill, he thought, would enable women to avoid surgery and end pregnancies in private. Baillieu knew the hormone progesterone was essential to pregnancy and began searching for an anti-hormone that would block progesterone. His idea came to fruition in 1980 when a French drug company created mifepristone, then called RU486. In 1988, the pill was approved in France. More than a dozen countries followed, and in 2000, the FDA approved mifepristone for use for up to 7 weeks into a pregnancy in the U.S. Belieu said he hoped the abortion pill might even help eliminate abortion as an issue. But after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last year, enabling states to outlaw abortion, mifepristone became a new battleground for the same reason Belieu sought to create it. It enables women to end pregnancy in their own homes. A federal judge with a long history of anti-abortion activism recently ordered the Food and Drug Administration to revoke its approval. That ruling has been stayed and is likely to be ultimately decided on appeal to the Supreme Court. How does it work? Mifepristone blocks progesterone, a hormone that prepares the uterus to receive and carry an embryo. The drug latches onto receptor molecules in place of progesterone, causing a miscarriage. In the U.S., mifepristone is usually followed by a second pill, misoprostol, 24 to 48 hours later, which causes contractions that empty the uterus. Misoprostol, which isn't currently at risk of being taken off the market, can be used alone to induce an abortion. However, it's only 87 to 93% effective on its own, compared with 95 to 99% when combined with mifepristone. How is the drug approved? During the 1980s and 90s, the U.S. banned importation or manufacture of RU486. But in 1994, the French pharmaceutical company, Roussel Ouklaf, donated all rights for mifepristone to the U.S., to the Population Council, which licensed it to Danco Laboratories. The company undertook years of clinical trials and applied to the FDA for approval, which was fiercely opposed by anti-abortion groups. "We're really very simplistic, visually oriented people," said Dr. John Wilkie of the National Right to Life Committee at the time. "If what mifepristone destroys in there doesn't look like a human, then it will make our job more difficult." In 2000, based on a review of three rounds of safety data over 4 years, the FDA approved mifepristone's use in abortions. How widely used is it? In recent years, the FDA has expanded access to the drug and approved it for use at home and via telemedicine. In 2016, the FDA broadened its use through up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. This year, it dropped a rule against retail pharmacies dispensing it with a prescription. Medication abortions are now more common than surgical procedures. In 2020, 53% of the country's 930,160 abortions used pills, up from 39% in 2017. Mifepristone is now available in at least 94 countries. Is it safe? It's safer than most drugs and pregnancy itself. Since the original FDA review process, over 100 studies have since confirmed that mifepristone is safe and effective, and millions of women have used it. No drug is totally without risk. But data on mifepristone show only 5 deaths for every 1 million uses, a lower rate than Tylenol, Viagra, or penicillin. In fact, penicillin's risk of death is 4 times greater, while Viagra's is almost 10 times greater. Federal Judge Matthew Kaczmarek nonetheless ruled last month that the FDA's 23-year-old approval of mifepristone should be rescinded, and echoed claims by anti-abortion groups that it's unsafe and causes many women to feel regret and suffer mental health issues. Instead of relying on the mountain of evidence demonstrating safety, the court turned to anecdotes from anti-abortion advocates and blog posts, said Ushma Upadhyaya, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of California, San Francisco. "That's not how scientific research works." Why is its safety at issue? Anti-abortion groups know it's the only way to challenge mifepristone's continued availability, which makes it very difficult for states to truly stop abortions. After the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last summer, 14 states banned abortion without exceptions, and dozens of clinics closed. Since the pill can be mailed or transported across state borders, it became critical to pro-choice groups' efforts to keep abortion accessible in the post-Roe era. Mifepristone, Gia Tolentino said in The New Yorker, is one of the principal reasons we are not going back to the era of coat hangers. Time for a few of the best columns. We'll start with two from the U.S. AI's alarming impact on politics. Soon, artificial intelligence will completely change the nature of campaigning, said Nathan E. Sanders and Bruce Schneier. Last week, the Republican National Committee previewed the future of politics by using AI to create realistic-looking scenes of the dystopia that would occur in a second Joe Biden term. China invading Taiwan, a U.S. financial collapse, a flood of immigrants across an open border, troops patrolling cities overrun with crime. The RNC included a small disclaimer that it had used AI imagery, but before long, political operatives will use AI to create remarkably realistic photos, videos, and news stories that voters don't know are fake. Campaigns could use AI to appeal to the individual proclivities of each voter, using easily obtainable data to tailor specific messages targeting their concerns. Online voters may find themselves holding political conversations with campaign-controlled chatbots that they think are people. These bots have already shown they can skillfully manipulate the emotions of their human users. Transparency laws are needed, such as requiring campaigns to disclose when text or images are generated by AI. But it seems implausible that new rules will be adopted in time for the 2024 election. RFK Jr.'s left-wing populism. Democrats aren't immune from the seductive lure of conspiracy theories, said Matt Lewis. That's the only explanation for the fact that the crackpot anti-vaxxer Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is polling close to 20% in recent surveys of Democratic voters for the 2024 presidential nomination. The late Senator Robert Kennedy's son, who recently announced his presidential candidacy, has little chance of beating Joe Biden for the nomination. But why is an imbecile with no qualifications being taken seriously by anyone? Kennedy's name is no doubt giving him a boost, and for decades he also benefited from positive coverage of his environmental extremism and anti-nuclear scaremongering by the mainstream liberal media. For two decades, Kennedy has been claiming childhood vaccines cause autism, refusing to back down in the face of a mountain of contrary evidence. Recently, he claimed that COVID vaccines are killing thousands and likened vaccine and max mandates to the Holocaust. RFK Jr. is so bonkers that far-right radical Steve Bannon has encouraged him to run. Yet a significant slice of Democratic voters support Kennedy anyway. Clearly, conspiratorial populism is on the rise in America, and not just on the right. This column comes from Israel. The bizarre hatred for Yiddish music. To American Jews, klezmer music is charming, if a bit old-fashioned, said Daniel Hoffman. It reminds us of weddings and bar mitzvahs. Israelis, though, simply despise it. To them, it represents the European past and those who are stuck in the past, obsessing over the Holocaust. As an American violinist, I knew about the Israeli dislike for the genre even before I moved here from California 2 decades ago. But back then, I was sure that the beauty and artistry of this music, with its clarinets and violins, its minor keys and folk dance rhythms, would eventually win Israeli hearts. It hasn't happened. Because klezmer is assumed to be the music of the Orthodox, it is tainted by association with the toxic religious political agenda of the far-right Orthodox parties, which at their most extreme want to make Israel a theological state. Yet Orthodox music in Israel is mostly vocal and has little to do with the interesting instrumental arrangements that klezmer musicians in the diaspora have developed. I still hope that Israelis will come around eventually and refuse to cede hundreds of years of rich Yiddish culture to the ultra-Orthodox. Klezmer music has an uncanny ability to turn on a dime between extremes of joy and sadness. What could be more Israeli than that? The last word, our in-depth article, haunted by the death penalty. After a series of exonerations and botched executions, prison officials are increasingly reluctant to do the killing, said Isaac Walour in the Dispatch. Just participating leaves many with PTSD. Ron McAndrew's third execution was the last he would oversee. On March 25, 1997, McAndrew, then the warden of the Florida State Prison in Rayford, watched as guards escorted Pedro Medina into the death chamber at the prison and strapped him into Old Sparky, the electric chair that had been in use since 1923. Medina had been convicted of the gruesome 1982 murder of Dorothy James, a 51-year-old elementary school teacher. "I am still innocent," Medina said when asked for his last words. Guards strapped his limbs into the chair, placed a saline-soaked sponge atop Medina's head, then latched an electrode on top of the sponge, followed by a copper helmet, and finally a mask over his face. At a secret signal from McAndrew, the executioner flipped the electrical current, and Medina's body jerked back as the fatal charge entered his body. Then it all went wrong. The sponge, which had been wrung too dry of the saline solution that should have conducted the electrical current into Medina's head, caught fire. Blue and orange flames shot from Medina's masked head. Smoke filled the execution chamber. So did the smell of burning flesh. "They're burning him alive," said attorney Michael Minerva, one of the execution's observers. More than 25 years later, McAndrew agreed, "We burned a man to death." As the execution went wrong, McAndrew had to decide whether to stop and retry or continue. "You have to put on a good show because there are a lot of people watching," he said. "You can't show any fear, hesitation, weakness of any kind." He decided to continue with a second electrical charge of a lower voltage. 4 minutes later, Medina was pronounced dead. After the Medina execution and public outcry, Governor Lawton Chiles sent McAndrew to Huntsville, Texas, to learn more about lethal injections. But that's when he began rethinking his position on the death penalty. The trauma of the Medina execution and personal connections with death row inmates began weighing on the Air Force veteran. "You get to know them, and then one day you go up and read them a death warrant," he said. "The mother shows you a picture of them as a high school boy on the basketball team. They're human beings. They're not just objects or numbers." McAndrew began having nightmares, which he saw the men he'd executed sitting on his bed, staring at him. He turned to pills and alcohol. He would eventually begin therapy, give up his addictions, and transfer to a different prison in Orlando. But first came one day in 1998. I woke up and said, "The death penalty is wrong." He called his superiors with one request: "Get me the hell out of here." Though it ebbs and flows, debate over the death penalty in the U.S. never really cools off. Support for it dipped as low as 42% in May 1966 and climbed as high as 80% in September 1994, according to Gallup polling. Gallup puts current support for the death penalty at 54%, while Pew puts it at 60%. In 2022, fewer than 50 dependents were sentenced to death, and only 20 executions were carried out in only 6 states. Part of this could be the effect of COVID-19 pandemic. 2020 saw 17 executions, and 2021 saw 11. Both years saw only 18 death sentences handed out by courts. The death penalty is significantly more expensive than any comparable penal alternative. The cost of a single execution can stretch into the millions. In Texas, the average death penalty case costs $2.3 million, 3 times more than imprisoning an inmate in maximum security for 40 years. The Death Penalty Information Center, DPIC, estimated that in 2000, Florida spent $51 million more in administering the death penalty than it would have punishing all first-degree murderers with life without parole. Plus, there are the extended appeals processes, increased costs for legal counsel and expert witnesses, which more and more defendants seem to understand. Robert Dunham, a one-time defender who worked on capital cases and the former director of DPIC, pointed out the importance of proper representation in capital cases. If you're well represented, you don't get the death penalty. Apart from the fluctuation in data, however, the national conversation over the death penalty is changing in other ways. More and more stories of faulty convictions come to light, possibly swaying public opinion. But so do stories of how the death penalty affects attorneys, judges, and the people tasked with carrying out executions. In 2002, Ray Crone became the 100th death row inmate exonerated since the Supreme Court ruled executions were constitutional in 1976 after the 4-year halt imposed by the court's decision in Furman versus Georgia. On December 29, 1991, a friend of then 34-year-old Crone, Kim Ancona, was found naked and stabbed to death in the men's bathroom of the Phoenix bar where she worked. A single beer, a glass, and Ancona's pocketbook were sitting on the bar next to the bar's open cash drawer. The knife used to kill the 21-year-old woman was found nearby, bent from the impact of multiple stab wounds. Someone alerted the police that Crone had helped Ancona close the bar the previous night, so they asked Crone for a styrofoam impression of his teeth to compare with bite marks on Ancona's body. 2 days later, police charged Crone with murder, kidnapping, and sexual assault, despite a witness giving a physical description of a suspect who didn't resemble Crone. "I didn't even get detention in high school," Crone says with a chuckle. Prosecutor used testimony from an allegedly expert witness, who was later discredited, to claim that Crone's teeth matched the bite marks on Ancona, but concealed from Crone's highly unqualified attorney the odontologist report that cast doubt on his guilt. The jury found Crone guilty, and in 1992 he was sentenced to death. In 1996, an appeals court ordered a new trial because of the prosecution's withholding of the odontologist report, but a new jury convicted him again on the basis of the expert witness bite mark testimony, a dubious form of evidence. But this time, the judge sentenced Crone to life in prison, citing concerns over Crone's innocence. Trapped in a prison cell and charged with a murder he never committed, Crone received constant support from family and friends, he told the Dispatch. They knew who I was. I established myself as a person of honor and integrity. Crone, a Christian, says he slept with the Bible under his pillow during his prison stay, drawing inspiration from the Old Testament stories of Job and Jonah. Still, each day in prison brought new danger. Crone had been stabbed and has watched as guards put down prison riots. You flatline your emotions. You don't get too excited about good news or too crushed by bad news, he said. On death row, Crone was allowed outside very little. At those times, he said, he'd listen for a motorcycle, a dog bark, something to remind me of the outside world. From 1992 to 2002, Crone's family reportedly spent more than $300,000 fighting to get him out of prison. In 2002, the break came. Crone's lawyer convinced an appeals court that DNA testing of saliva found at the site of Ancona's murder implicated another man, Kenneth Phillips Jr. Phillips would later be sentenced to 53 years to life for Ancona's murder. On April 29, 2002, Ray Crone walked out of an Arizona prison a free man. The return to normal life came with struggles Crone described as amusing. He had to learn how to use a microwave and cell phone, respond to voicemail, and sleep on mattresses much softer than his prison bunk. The exoneration of an imprisoned man like Crone isn't unique, though it doesn't happen much with death row inmates. At least 190 individuals sentenced to death in America in the past 50 years have been found to be wrongfully convicted and exonerated. Even death penalty advocates like Joshua Marquis, a former longtime Oregon district attorney who has both prosecuted and defended capital cases, are realistic about the risks associated with the death penalty. I don't believe that the system is infallible. If we keep executing people, it is statistically probable that we will execute an innocent person, he said. Crone is one of the super rare exceptions. It shouldn't happen. I completely understand why he and his supporters believe what they do. The issue doesn't necessarily fall neatly along partisan lines. Some conservatives are turning away from capital punishment out of skepticism of the government itself and concerns over Americans' civil liberties. I think those on the political right take it for granted that you're supposed to support capital punishment. Mark Hyden, a former manager at the advocacy group Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty, said, "For myself, I can't get the government to fill a pothole next to my house. That's the government we're trusting with the death penalty?" More than a third of all American executions were botched in 2022, according to DPIC. These botches reportedly occurred as a result of executioner incompetence, failures to follow protocols, or defects in the protocols themselves, including death teams being unable to set IV lines in the veins of the condemned. In extraordinary cases like that of Medina, the inmate who died in the fiery 1997 execution, the botches leave both witnesses and executioners scarred. Even in legitimate executions, though, correctional staff can carry scars for years. When I started trying to pull the execution program together, the well-being of the staff I was recruiting was key, former prison warden Frank Thompson told the Dispatch. I wanted to make sure that there were no more victims than there have to be, beyond the inmate. Thompson grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas, and remembers the 1955 lynching of Emmett Till as a formative time for his opinion on the death penalty. Outraged by the senseless murder of a fellow black boy at the hands of Mississippi racists, Thompson and many others in his community supported the death penalty for Till's murderers. Thompson eventually became superintendent of the Oregon State Penitentiary System in Salem from 1994 to 1998. A year and a half into work, he received the death warrant for Douglas Wright, a serial killer responsible for the 1991 murders of several homeless men and the kidnapping, molestation, and murder of a 10-year-old boy. Wright opted not to appeal his death sentence and said he hoped his death would bring peace and closure to his victims' families in a written statement released after his execution. Wright was the state's first execution in 34 years, and Thompson was tasked with creating a new protocol for lethal injections in Oregon. Finding a team of men willing to oversee executions was far from easy, especially the person to deliver the fatal injection. There was a young man who'd walk to my office, and we would occasionally talk, and one day he said, "Mr. Thompson, I can sense what you're going through. If there's anything I can do to help, let me know." When Thompson asked him to be the one to administer the injection, the young man was completely blindsided. His jaw dropped to the floor, and he said, "Boss, look, when I offered to help you, I had no idea that you might call on me to administer the lethal injection." But a week later, he accepted. Thompson recalled training the young man with the practice syringe. There was a surreal sense of, "I'm training this man to kill someone." Thompson's team carried out Oregon's only two executions in 54 years, one in 1996 and the next in 1997. Between the first and second executions, several members of the execution team quit, some later struggling with PTSD, according to Thompson. For every condemned person executed, the number of people put at lifetime of risk are multiplied by the number of people involved in conducting the execution, he said. "Why do we allow this to happen to the decent men and women who are our civil servants?" A version of this article originally appeared in the Dispatch. We'll read an obituary this week. The Calypso King Who Fought for Civil Rights. Harry Belafonte, 1927-2023. Harry Belafonte was an American legend. An electrifying performer, he was the first Black Emmy Award winner, the first Black man to win a Tony, and the first person of any race to have a record sell more than 1 million copies. But he also made history beyond the entertainment world. A major bankroller of his friend Martin Luther King Jr. and a key liaison between Black activists and Hollywood, he helped the civil rights movement gain wider public acceptance. The cause of justice animated nearly everything he did. Even Deo, the banana boat song, the playful Calypso tune that became his calling card, had a political message. It spoke about the struggles of the people who are underpaid, who are victims of colonialism, he said in 2011. It talked about our aspirations for a better way of life. Belafonte was born Harold George Belinfante, Jr. in Harlem, said Time, into a childhood rife with hardship and sorrow. His father from Martinique and a mother from Jamaica, both mixed race, were undocumented immigrants who constantly changed jobs, apartments, and even their names to avoid authorities. And they parked him with relatives in Jamaica from age 9 to 13. Suffering from undiagnosed dyslexia, he dropped out of high school and joined the Navy at age 17, hoping for adventure and glory, but was instead relegated to grunt work loading munitions onto ships in New Jersey. After his service, he worked as a janitor in New York City building where, in 1945, a tenant gave him tickets to a play at the American Negro Theater. That experience proved life-changing. He joined the troupe, which included Sidney Poitier, who had become a lifelong friend, and enrolled in drama classes. Belafonte first made his mark as a nightclub singer, said Variety. With traditional tunes such as Deo and Matilda, he single-handedly spawned a Calypso craze, and his third album, 1956 Calypso, spent a staggering 31 weeks atop the charts. Handsome and charismatic, he left audiences spellbound, said the New York Times, and Hollywood took notice. He became a near-instant matinee idol, appearing alongside Dorothy Dandridge in 1954's Carmen Jones, an all-black update of the opera Carmen. Yet with success came a racist backlash. His status as Joan Fontaine's love interest in 1957's Island in the Sun generated outrage in the segregated South, and he quit his Emmy-winning 1959 variety show, Tonight with Belafonte, after CBS tried to modify the show following Southern complaints about the integrated cast. Frustrated, Belafonte used his celebrity to turn a spotlight on injustice, said the Washington Post. He co-organized the 1963 March on Washington, where King gave his I Have a Dream speech, and invited Hollywood luminaries such as Marlon Brando, Rita Moreno, and Paul Newman to come, giving them a prominent place directly in the path of TV cameras. That same year, he raised $50,000 to bail King and other activists out of jail in Birmingham, Alabama. The next year, he joined Poitier to personally deliver $70,000 to protesters in Mississippi, where the pair narrowly escaped a Ku Klux Klan ambush. His visibility made him a target for surveillance. He later found out that his manager and therapist were both FBI informants. After King's 1968 assassination, Belafonte became a roving humanitarian without portfolio. He was a driving force behind the star-studded 1985 single, We Are the World, and after a long campaign against apartheid in South Africa, he helped organize Nelson Mandela's first visit to the U.S. in 1990. Belafonte was forever uncompromising in his desire to change America and the world, said USA Today. In a 2006 meeting with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, he called George W. Bush the greatest terrorist in the world. He said Barack Obama didn't care enough about poor people, and he compared Donald Trump to Adolf Hitler. The resulting controversies didn't faze him. I've always looked at the world and thought, what can I do next? How can we fix it? He said in a 2011 documentary. And that's still how I look at the world, because there is so much to be done. On the health and science page, we have, why are the oceans so hot? The ocean right now is hotter than ever before, shattering every record since measurements began. Data collected from satellites and buoys by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration show temperatures higher than any previous year for 42 consecutive days, with a global average surface temperature of 21 degrees Celsius, 70 degrees Fahrenheit. Meteorologists are stumped as to the cause of the sudden rise in warming, especially since this is a time of year when ocean temperatures usually decline. While this year is expected to feature an El Niño weather system, which typically warms the Pacific, that hasn't kicked in yet. Some researchers think the oceans may have simply begun to reach their capacity to absorb heat. For decades, the oceans have been taking in more than 90% of the world's excess heat from greenhouse gas emissions. But there is a limit. Warming oceans are a worry for many reasons. They expand water volume and accelerate sea level rise, hold less oxygen and therefore support less marine life, and absorb less carbon dioxide. The fact that it is warming as much as it is has been a real surprise and very concerning. Mike Meredith of the British Antarctic Survey tells The Guardian, it could be a short-lived extreme high, or it could be the start of something much more serious. Parrots that make video calls. Parrots that live in captivity rarely get to socialize with their own species, but a new study shows that they can take easily to video chatting. In the study, 18 birds were trained to use an iPad to look at photos of the other birds and tap on the one they wanted to call. Over just 2 months, the birds initiated 147 calls. Certain birds quickly developed friendships, singing and preening to one another and phoning back and forth frequently. In some interactions, they would copy one another, one hanging upside down when the other did. In others, they would show off their toys. A few times, they fell asleep together. And several of them learned new tricks by watching their friends, including, in at least one case, how to fly. Part of the fun thing for me, and a surprising thing, was how these parrots sort of bonded together, the researcher Elena Douglas tells the Washington Post. They did want to video call each other. They did have preferences. While the study ended months ago, many of the parrots have continued to call each other up. And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page, starting with Kamala Harris. The pressure is on. It's no accident that Vice President Kamala Harris appears more than a dozen times in the video kicking off President Biden's reelection campaign, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Biden's age, he'd be 86 at the end of a second term, will give his running mate outsized importance in the 2024 election. But Harris, 58, has had a rocky tenure as VP. She's drawn no-win assignments like the migrant crisis at the border, and the tangled syntax of her speeches and the off-the-cuff comments is frequently criticized as word salad. Her approval rating is mired at about 40%. Republican candidate Nikki Haley has already previewed the GOP line of attack, crudely speculating that Biden will not last to 2028, so you are really counting on a President Harris. On the campaign trail, Harris has to persuade voters that she's prepared to assume the awesome responsibilities of Commander-in-Chief without suggesting she will. Biden's campaign has no choice but to revive Harris, said Noah Rothman in National Review. Voters are keenly aware of the grim actuarial arithmetic that haunts the aging president, with a recent poll finding that 63% expect that Harris will wind up taking over at some point if Biden is reelected. The problem for Democrats is that Harris has shown no real skills as a politician or speaker, which is why she flopped so badly as a 2020 presidential candidate. The former California prosecutor is transparently inauthentic, said Zachary Faria in the Washington Examiner, and desperately tries to sound smarter and more profound than she is. What comes out is gobbledygook, such as, quote, the concerns based on what we should all be concerned about, and this moment as a moment that is about great momentum. Biden cannot ignore this issue, said Thomas L. Friedman in the New York Times. With Donald Trump running again, the stakes are enormous. And if swing voters doubt Biden's health and Harris' competence, the country is in trouble. Over the next year and a half, Biden needs to give Harris meaningful work that would elevate her profile, such as overseeing rural economic development. And Harris has to assert herself, ideally by showing more forcefully what she can do. In 2024, the incumbent vice president will matter maybe more than in any other election in American history. And a few of the short notes. The Supreme Court has decided fewer cases at this point in its nine-month term than at any time in the past 100 years. So far, it has decided just 15 cases, with 44 left to go before the term ends next month. In 2019, the court had decided 28 cases by this point in the term. In 2018, it was 30. States that have adopted stand-your-ground laws have had a 55% higher gun homicide rate over the past 2 years than states that did not adopt them. These laws remove the duty to try to retreat from a threat before using deadly force. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis married his wife Casey at Disney World in 2009. The couple exchanged vows at a pavilion overlooking Cinderella's castle in the Seven Seas Lagoon, which DeSantis recently admitted was ironic, given his ongoing battle with Disney. Viewership on Fox News during Tucker Carlson's former 8 p.m. slot dropped last week by more than 50% to 1.3 million. Viewership at the far-right network Newsmax tripled during that time slot to 510,000 viewers. On the poll watch, on the eve of King Charles' coronation, only 29% of Britons said the monarchy is very important, a 9-point drop from 2022. 45% said the monarchy is not important. 25% said it should be abolished. And we'll finish out the show today with a quote from Vasily Grossman, quoted in the Wall Street Journal, who says, "This kindness, this stupid kindness, is what most truly human in a human being." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.